Sorry, I totally guessed what he was doing.
If you breathe now, it goes in why you told her. Parshas Mishpatim is a very complicated parsha. And the first thing that brings up everyone's discussion is what is it doing at this particular juncture in the Chumash. Particularly, if you look at the end of the parsha, and since it's such a long, complicated parsha, and not everybody gets to the end of the parsha goes back to Maamar Har Sinai. Right? So there's an interruption in talking about Maamar Har Sinai, so I said, Dibros, you then have all these dinim, or mishpatim, and then you go back to Maamar Har Sinai. So obviously, there's a message being sent in why we put this here, right? You normally you should finish the story of Maamar Har Sinai and then go to the next item. So that's why first Rashi, that the Vav is indicative of a continuation. So Ma'el Mi Sinai of El Mi Sinai. But it means not just technically it's also Mi Sinai. It really means that the Aseres HaDibros, as lofty as they are, have to be translated into actual functional life. And so the Mefarshim all discuss which aspect of the Aseres HaDibros are translated through Parsha Mishpatim. Some say it's Losachmo, that you shouldn't be envious of what other people have, can be understood only in the context of defining what ownership means, right? Who has something, and what I have a right to have, and what I don't have a right to have, that is the context in which we can understand Losachmo. If we don't have clear definitions of how I acquire things, and who owns things, then you can't. One could say it refers to this whole second half of the Aseres HaDibros, because all the surahs are mentioned in two words, right? Lasirza, Lasina. What happens if you, what is the punishment? What are the criteria, right? How do we know if someone, like my son, hurts someone else and they go to the hospital and they survive for a while and then they get sick again, you know? You wouldn't be able to figure any of that out just from the two words, Lasirza, right? So you need this for that. I want to suggest something different. Not that my place to argue with all the Mefarshim, but because I'm going to ask a different question. And that is, of all the areas which could be discussed in Mishpatim, why should we start discussing with the laws of Eved Ivri? We can start, you say, want to clarify Tirzach, so we'll talk about, you know, right after Eved Ivri and Amar Ivriya, we talk about murder, right? We want to talk about giving questions of ownership and court systems. It's all discussed later in the parasha. Of all things to start with, why should we start with the dinim of Eved Ivri? So there are a number of explanations that are given for why specifically we start with Eved Ivri. One is, if we follow the pattern of the Rishonim, who say this is all an explanation of the Aseres HaDibros, a clarification and expansion. So it goes back then to the first of Aseres HaDibros, right? The whole notion is that we're taken out of slavery. And Eved Ivri somehow is going to teach us a different kind of avadim, or what the limitations in people being avadim. Right? So let's look at that. And what do we see about Eved Ivri? So how does one become an Eved Ivri, first of all? So there are two ways. Only one described in this parasha. and one described later in Dvar. The one described in this parasha refers to an individual who stole money and can't pay back, doesn't have the money. He took the money and he went out and he went to a nice restaurant and, or he went to a store and bought something, the item got lost, and he doesn't have the money to pay back. So Beis Din has the right, Beis Din sells him for the 6-year period in order to have the money to go back to the person who was stolen. And the Rambam says very interestingly, even though the din is that a ganav pays kefil, that if I steal something, I have to pay back double. You don't get sold for an eved ivri because you can't pay the kefil. You get sold for an eved ivri if you can't pay back the original amount. So that's one. The other case is the person who sells himself. Person sees he can't make it, in the system. He just can't find a job. He can't find a way of making his ends meet. And the only way he can do it is to, sell himself to be an eved ivri. And therefore, there's a certain amount of money, one that comes in being sold. And secondly, while he's working, the master has to provide food and clothing for him. So he at the present to me, can't make it in society. There, for the period of time that he sold, he can basically have his needs met. So it's interesting, this talks about the one being sold by Beis Din, which means it's not that we're promoting people being avadim. It's a recognition that there are other factors, right? We know that we're not supposed to be avadim. In fact, if I can just skip a couple of psukim ahead, the person who doesn't want to leave after 6 years, right? Then is a nirtza, right? Why did he make the home here? Because he should have heard not to become avadim, you're not supposed to become an eved. And the fact that he wants to stay as an eved, so it's a reminder that there's something wrong. So I can ask that question. If something's wrong, why don't we say no? It's 6 years. Period's over. There's no such thing as stay. So I think the answer to both the questions are, one, that a fundamental principle of Yadus is Bechira Chavshus, the person has free will. And free will even means the ability to make poor choices. Right? So if a person wants to stay as an eved, the nitza, even though clearly we know it's a poor choice, it's a non-desired choice, but we don't take the choice away from him, right? We indicate very strongly by piercing the air, you shouldn't be making this choice. But if you're willing to make such a choice and pay the consequences, that's what part of what Bechira Chavshus is. So it's interesting that even the Nirtza goes out with Yovel, right? Even though we let you make the bad choice, we don't let you make it absolutely. No, there's no absolute, I just want to be a slave, I don't want to take responsibility for anything. No, the concept is Yovel, and it has to stop at some point. That we understand that Yovel could, it all depends when in the cycle of years, whether Yovel's going to come right away, Yovel's not going to come for another 40 years, which may be after, after May of Asherim, as we say. And that's one thing. The notion of how important Bechira Chavshus is, that even if you make a bad choice, we let you make the choice. We don't make it impossible to make choices. There's a responsibility, and responsibility means you can make a choice. And secondly, let's talk about Nimka Beis Din, because this tells us something about all of Mishpatim. If you would ask in American law, right, someone steals, so what? And they get arrested, and the question, what's the punishment? He may have to go to jail for 1 year, for 5 years, whatever it is. So what is the concern of the legal system? That the person who steals be incarcerated so he won't be a danger to others, right? It's a deterrent. And he won't be a danger to others. What's the concern in the halachic system? That the person whose money was stolen gets his money back. Right? Why is he sold? Notice, I said he's not sold, he didn't have the money for the kefal, because he didn't have the money to pay back the person who was stolen. So the halakhic system, as in this context, is more concerned with the protecting the person who was the victim, getting his money back, than punishing the criminal. Right? Our primary concern is to protect the victim. And that concern is such that if he doesn't have the money, what has to be done is there's some way that he provides the money. And if there's no other way to provide the money, that he becomes an eved for the 6 years, so be it. The person who, the victim can't suffer because the criminal, went and spent all the money that he stole. So that raises an important question. So what happens to the deterrent component? Right? Which means if the ganav has the money to pay back, that's all that happens then. Right? Obviously, you say, neighbor, there's kefal, he's going to lose more money than he got. It's not going to be worth it for him. But if he's a gazlan, he only has to pay back the amount. He doesn't pay extra. It's different between a ganav and a gazlan. So this raises a very interesting discussion, which is, do you do anything beyond the mishpat that the Torah says? So the Gemara discusses makin tva'on shum shlo min hadin, the ability of Bezdin to punish beyond what the halacha requires if it's necessary as a deterrent, because there's a lot of crime. Right? There's a lot of crime, even though the Torah just says all you have to do is pay back. Bezdin has the right to punish in other ways in order to protect society. Right? That even though the goal is that the victim not lose, right, we have an obligation to protect society. So if it's a serious amount of crime, you have an obligation to protect the society. Who has the right to do this? So the Gemara talks about the right of Bezdin, of the Sanhedrin, and also discusses the right of the melech, the king. Where the king, and for our purposes, means government. Right? They had a monarchy. They don't always have a monarchy. The king means the government. The government has a responsibility for the functioning of society. There's one Rishon, the Ran, actually, it could be the Rashba says something similar. The Ran, there's also a sefer called Rosh HaRan, which is not a parish on the Gemara, but separate Rosh the Ran gave. And in one of them, and Parsha Shoftim, Shpatim, Shoftim sounds a little similar, the Ran says that there really is a dual court system. That the halachic court system is what's the real emes, and this is what should be done theoretically, but practically, it doesn't always serve to preserve the welfare of the society. For example, we know that in order to convict someone of a serious crime, one needs two eyewitnesses. Now that we need two eyewitnesses, they have to go to the individual beforehand and warn him. Do you know that if you're Mechalel Shabbos, you're going to be Chayav Misa? Right? Now, that's not a common phenomenon, right? And let's say a case of a murderer. If I know if someone wants to kill somebody else, and they two witnesses come to him and say, "We're watching you, and we're warning you now that if you kill him, you're Chayav Misa," he's probably going to not kill him that much time, right? He's going to wait till the witnesses go away, where he can get away with it. So even though we chas v'shalom don't want to punish someone who's not guilty, and therefore we have to the highest standard of evidence to convict him, functionally, it means we're very rarely going to convict anybody of anything. So if we're very rarely going to convict anybody of anything, so we meet the standard of emes, right? The emes is that you won't, you know, chas v'shalom don't convict someone for a crime that he's not guilty of, right? That's wrong. On the other hand, you don't necessarily protect society. If the standard of proof is so high, so then you can have endless crime going on in society, people are just going to be careful. We know, for example, that Rachmana Litzlan, there's some terrible things that are always done privately, right? You know, unfortunately, we hear stories about people abusing children. You think people they have witnesses watching them when they abuse children? So they do with their no witnesses, and the child is not even kosher to testify because he's a katan, right? So if we say nope, what can we do? You know, they didn't do in front of witnesses, so we'll be derelict in protecting the people who need to be protected. So the Ran says that you always have two court systems. Was meant to be two court systems. The mishpatim of the Torah, which are the way things absolutely theoretically should be, and functionally you have to have another system with a lower standard of proof, which is necessary to protect and ensure that the society functions properly. You need to have both. Which is a broad and interesting topic in its own. I want to suggest an additional shot, which I haven't found written anywhere yet. Keep on looking. But my mind works in strange ways. So I usually come up with things and no one says before, which means either that it's strange before, or we have a rule that, you know, something's always left for us to come up with, right? Nothing is ever. Now everything hasn't been said yet, so there's room left. We start off talking about an evidence. We're talking about a person who steals and doesn't have the money to pay for it, use up the money. We then talk about a new. Talk about a person who is so satisfied with not being responsible in life and being a slave. I like my master. I like having a wife and children, even though the wife and children are not halachically fully Jewish, right? So it's a non-Jewish woman slave. Children are not going to be fully halachic. Makes my life easy, right? We're certainly not talking about the better elements in society, right? We're next going to learn about the person who sells his own daughter, even though we can explain it that it's not really that it's meant for the master to marry her or for his son to marry her. Still, hard to imagine that we would admire a person who sold his daughter to be a slave, right? If we had to pick people, you know, to admire, it'd be probably at the bottom of the list. And I think Bedafka, that's why we start with these things. That the Chazal, that the Torah is telling us that in order to have proper mishpat, you have to deal even with you have to have laws even for the lowest elements of society. You can't say, we have to have a proper legal system for the people who are nice people, but for the criminals, throw them in jail. Who cares? No. You have to have, in order to really have proper mishpat, you have to have mishpat even for the fellow who sells his daughter. And there have to be laws for that too, right? Has to be done in such a way and restricted and with certain consequences. In order to have a real society based on Torah, it has to deal with the ugly stuff as well. Can't only just deal with the love, with the, you know, the beautiful principles and everything wonderful. It's got to deal with the bottom of society and find laws for them as well. And I think that's a very powerful notion. I want to say, I don't have too much time left. I think I have a few minutes. I just want to comment on something later in the parasha. There's so many things one could comment on in the parasha. There's a pasuk lo sedar dal berivo, right? But it says you shouldn't favor the poor in his dispute. And actually, someone spoke in yeshiva and said, "We don't believe in social justice. We don't know. Look, we don't." If you look at all the other pasukim, you have so many pasukim about. We have twice in the parasha says that you can't mistreat a ger. Not once, twice in one parasha, just a few pasukim apart. You have it about how HaKadosh Baruch Hu worries about the poor, worries about the orphans and the widows. So what is the real message of this pasuk? The real message of this pasuk is that of course you should be concerned about the poor, the needy, the orphans and the widows. But mishpat is mishpat. Right? Mishpat has to be straight. A bezdin has to function properly. And even if it comes out, the result of mishpat is that the multimillionaire wins and the pauper loses, it has to be. Because mishpat has to be mishpat. Obviously we have an obligation to help the pauper out. But justice must be, as they say in secularly, blind. It has to be. Otherwise it's not mishpat. And even if you bend over to help the person in need, it's no longer mishpat. Right? And that's the part. It's not talking about we're not concerned with the poor and setting up any system to protect those in need. Of course we do. It says yes, but when we talk about mishpat, mishpat has to be straight. Right? They talk about the psukim talk about not taking shochad. If you look in the Gemara, when the Gemara talks about shvuas, the Gemara has stories that seem extreme. That if somebody delivered food to one of the tanoim, he said, "I'm possible to be a dayan." You really think he was not? He can be bribed so cheaply? No. It has to be clear. It could be not even what they call an appearance of being affected by some external factor, but the justice of the case. And that's another very critical part of what we think of mishpat. Mishpat has to be done justice. There are all kinds of ramifications otherwise, so then you have to fix them up. Right? Having said that, of course, to be fair, there is one possible exception to this, and that's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Yeshiva learned Sanhedrin just the other year. And that is, in the first paragraph of Sanhedrin, there's a whole discussion about din and pshara. Din is what we've been talking about. Din is you go to court, you have a nice volume of zechar shel mishpat, you look up the din, and you paskin, according to what the halacha says, consequences are irrelevant, because mishpat is mishpat, but as I just said. But there is a notion of pshara. The notion of pshara is that sometimes the Beis Din can come to some kind of mediation, accommodation. I don't know which word to use in English, because it's not exactly. That means that acknowledging that in life, there's usually some justification for each side of an argument. Even though technically one side's going to win halakhically. But there's always some, there's always some argument on the other side, so the Beis Din has the right to offer, instead of real din, pshara, that we're going to listen to both sides and come up with something that takes into account the fact that there's something to be said for either side. It doesn't mean an automatic 50-50 split, we just don't make any judgment at all. It could end up a 90-10 split, but the din often ends up 100% zero. Right? Then someone wins and someone loses, in the large majority of cases. So Chazal have introduced an alternative pshara. And which is fascinating, if you study the Gemara and Sanhedrin, there is opinions that pshara is preferable to din, because this way everybody gets something, to the opinion that you never do pshara. Pshara is terrible, because din is din. Din is meant to be din. There's a whole debate about doing stock or mishpat. because tzedakah implies charity, and mishpat is sin. So one view in the Gemara is that's pshara. The pshara means that you take into account other considerations, and therefore everybody gets something. Right? And therefore it deals with reality of life, that there's something to be said for both sides. And but Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi says, no, you do straight mishpat. Why tzedakah? Because when you leave, the person feels, I was heard properly in court, din is the din, and I accept the din as it comes out. How do we function? Now, end with something. We function is that you offer pshara initially. Western orphans pshara. What's called pshara krovel din. Pshara krovel din means that yes, it's an accommodation, but it's based on the din. It's not just simply, okay, I'll give you half. You figure out the din, and then you modify it to take into consideration all other factors. But you can only do it when you start, right? You can't start off doing din and then say, okay, I changed my mind. I'm sure I don't think I'm going to do well other din. Now, you start off, and when you start accepting something, you can't back off and say, no, I'll try something else. Maybe it'll work better for me. So the conclusion is that, and this will end, that mishpatim are the essence of taking the Aseres Dibros and applying it into life. Life is very complex. And that, I like the point I said, so I'll repeat it, that you start with Eved Ivri, that even the lowest levels of society have to be dealt with mishpat, right? You can't just say, well, who cares about them? We have to maintain the chira, which is why you can have the nirtza to a certain degree, even though we obviously it's not what we're meant to be. And that justice is blind, right? And he goes straight. But the Torah itself allows for the option of pshara to take into consideration other things. Yeah, I think that's the time I was supposed to use. By the way, there's a fascinating Rashbam, it's in the Torah Chaim, in the beginning of Mishpatim, right? Where the Rashbam explains that he's going to do this for Mikra, and it won't always correspond to Halacha. He says it in Mishpatim, because Mishpatim is where he comes to play the most. And he says the Halacha is determined by Yiturim, by extra hints in the past. Why he feels the necessity to do it that way is a good question. But the Rashbam, who is after all grandson of Rashi, and a Baal Tosfos, of a Basra, but you get the Keskabatim, and then Rashi, you don't have Rashi, it's all the Rashbam from there on. And at the same time, he learns even Mishpatim, Api Pshuta Shomikra, not Api that which is the Halacha. He said, why he does so is a good question. I just point out that it's there.
According to all of the Rishonim now,